Okay, good.
Is it visible, Project?
I've got the text up on the screen, but it's compressed. I can't actually read it. That's better. And if I can get rid of this, okay. So we're on question six, is it?
Yes, Praji.
Okay. Nancy Copper Trubis, Sarah Creeper, Sindhu Viva, Sarah Petit, and Pamani Bill, Vice the Baby, and the Moon Maha. Shilla Prabhupada, Ki Jai. All right, so we're going to continue on where we left off, more or less. We're on question six, and it says, want to know about Prabhupada telling about his relishing his own writings and encouraging his disciples in writing. So there's a lot actually that could be said, about Prabhupada do it, as you say here, relishing his writing. There's several instances where we heard Prabhupada say that he's not doing the writing actually, but it's Krishna writing through him. I had a short conversation with him in September of 1976. Hari Kesh was there, I believe, also, and it was just after breakfast, Prabhupada's breakfast, and we were sitting in his room, just kind of light talk, I suppose you could say. There's one verse, I can't remember it. It gives all the qualities of a devotee. What's that? It's from the third canto. Anyway, so Prabhupada said, just hold on a second. There we go. All right. So Prabhupada was just talking with us in his room, and he quoted this verse. About the qualities of a sadhu. And Prabhupada was listening to Hari Kesh reading that out aloud. And Prabhupada said that he said he was glorifying the Sanskrit language, and he said that just see how beautiful the Bhagavatam is. That every word is relishable, and Hari Kesh, after reading out the qualities of the Vaishnavas, he said, "Well, I don't think that anybody's following this standard except for you, Srila Prabhupada." So Prabhupada deflected it a little bit, but he said, "No, I say." This is my writing, but I know it is not my writing. It is Krishna's. When I wrote that purport, then he said I could do it then, but I couldn't do it again now. In other words, that Prabhupada was so immersed in his writings, so he would sometimes, be amazed himself at is translation work, the, you know, the standard of the Bhagavatam, etc., etc. And you have to excuse me a minute. I had some notes which I put to one side. Anyway, Prabhupada made that this comment. He said that I know it is Krishna's writing. It's not, when I say my writing, it's not my writing, it is Krishna's writing. So that was one exchange that I had personally with Prabhupada, and he'd said that on different occasions. He's not the actual author. Krishna is the author, and he's just allowing Krishna to speak through him. So let's see. There's a in the second part of the first canto, in the introduction to the second volume. This is the these are the volumes that were taken by printed in India, and then they were taken by Prabhupada to America. So Prabhupada, by the time he got settled in at the Radha-Damodar temple, that was about 1961. That was when Prabhupada started writing the Bhagavatam, you know, with earnest. After he published the first part of the first canto, apparently a friend of his had questioned what was the point of it, that Prabhupada was already like 65. Now he's taking on this task, monumental task, of translating and publishing the whole Srimad Bhagavatam just hold on. Anyway, so his friend, he had told Prabhupada, you know, you're already at the age of retirement. What's the use in trying to, you know, write the Bhagavatam in English language? Where's the audience? Prabhupada wrote, he wrote back, or he quoted this comment that his friend had made. And Prabhupada's reply to that was that, actually, I'm attempting this, but in the heavenly planets, the demigods, they have access to millions of volumes of the Bhagavatam. In other words, it's not, you know, restricted. So if I do, you know, my work here, it's very small compared to what is being done in other places. So Prabhupada wasn't daunted by the task. In one sense, you could say he was being overly optimistic from a mundane point of view, that he had started on the translation of the Bhagavatam about 1960. Prabhupada had moved into the Radha-Damodar in about 1960-61. And if you look in, you know, logistically, what he was trying to do, there were 18,000 verses in the Bhagavatam, and he was he translated and commentated on the first canto, doing the whole first canto from 1960 to 65. That took him about 4 years. So if you calculate that if the first canto took 4 years, and there's still another 11 cantos to come, then it was really not very realistic from a material point of view. Prabhupada, an ordinary man, wouldn't probably even think about trying to do anything at that age. But Prabhupada was, fully confident that he had Krishna's blessings and his spiritual master's blessings to get these books out, even though he had no audience or help. So if you calculate, the first canto was took 4 years, and then there's 11 more cantos. If you average them out at 4 years per canto, then that means that Prabhupada, if he, things continued at that speed, Prabhupada would actually be about 115 years old by the time that he had finished the whole task. So it's reasonable to question, was Prabhupada being overly optimistic in taking up the task? But for him, he was just relying on Krishna, and he had no help at that time. He had no aspirations. He had some thoughts about going to the West, but he had no means to do so. But he continued doing his translation work regardless. And that's, a good indicator of Prabhupada's relishing, as you say, his writing. Prabhupada's Bhagavatam translation, that was the most important thing for him in it, for his own personal writing. And everything that Prabhupada did in establishing the Krishna consciousness movement was on the basis of his writing. So Prabhupada was enthusiastic always to get the Bhagavatam written. And as we see, when Prabhupada went to New York in 1965 and beginning of 1966, he just had, a few hundred sets of this first canto. And, he was going from shop to shop, to the coffee houses, the other New York-based publishers, and at least you can say that Krishna responded to his enthusiasm by making available the means by which he could actually write. In Vrindavan, he'd been using a manual typewriter. As I said, logistically, it would have been an impossible task. But as soon as Prabhupada arrived in America, of course, and he met these boys, Ganga Muni tells a story about how he saw this dictaphone machine. And I think Prabhupada had seen it also. He said that I saw the doctor would see a patient and then he would give him his prescription, but he would speak it on a dictaphone. And then that tape recording would be given to the secretary of the doctor, and that she would type them out and then give them back to the doctor. So, in other words, as soon as Prabhupada arrived in America, on a seemingly impossible task, because his enthusiasm was excuse me a minute, 1 minute. Okay, I'm sorry about this. Anyway, that was Prabhupada's personal service, was writing his books, and of course, he used to tell his disciples also that as we are writing, as he is writing, then we should also do some writing. He very much approved of that. And in the 1950s, when Prabhupada had retired from family life and he had gone to live in Jhansi, he was working on the Back to Godhead magazine or newspaper. And you can see throughout the 1950s, then he'd get two issues or three issues out, then later on another six issues. In 1960, he published 12 issues of the Back to Godhead. And then he stopped working on the BTG, and he started working on it, on his Bhagavatam translations. So the BTG wasn't stopped exactly, but it was suspended. So you see, when Prabhupada came to America, he immediately was given the means to, you know, he was given the means by which, you know, he could actually become realistic about publishing the whole of the 12 cantos of the Bhagavatam by getting him, you know, this dictaphone machine. Then he didn't have to sit there and manually type everything out anymore. People like Satsarup Maharaj and several others, they took over, Hayagriva, they took over the logistics, the work of taking Prabhupada's comments and, you have to excuse me. I actually took some medicine earlier this morning, and it's kind of slowed me down a bit. But anyway, the point is that when Prabhupada came to America, he got this dictaphone machine. He got people that could use it, people that were already qualified as English teachers. They could do the all the work that he was doing on his own. He could now find, he almost immediately found other people and equipment which could speed things up. So in that way, Prabhupada wasn't, he wasn't daunted. He wasn't put off by, you know, the translation of the Bhagavatam and the purports. He wasn't put off by the enormity of the task. He just kept on going, and as he did, Krishna then brought, you know, into focus everything that Prabhupada needed to actually produce the entire Bhagavatam. So I'm a bit spaced out here at the moment. Is there another question? Okay, number seven, want to know Prabhupada's conversations on deity worship, some instructions regarding worshipping the deities, which you personally recorded. To be perfectly honest, I don't know very much about deity worship. When I was traveling with Prabhupada, there were some installations of deities, because I was with Prabhupada in 1976, the first big deities to be Radhakrishna worship was in 1969, I think, in New York. And Prabhupada wanted to, they just purchased this building in Los Angeles, same building that we have now. And Prabhupada wanted to use that facility there as a training center. So he had declared that the Los Angeles Temple was the international headquarters of ISKCON. He would invite temple presidents and others to come and spend a few weeks in L.A., and learn how to do the learn how to do the deity worship. I think there was a lady called Shilavati, and of course Jamuna Devi, one of the first San Francisco devotees. They were actually deputed by Prabhupada to train up the rest of his disciples in the proper standards. So it was very simple to begin with, nothing elaborate. Prabhupada didn't want the deity worship to become, you know, an overwhelming task. The main thing that he was focused on, of course, was developing a preaching organization. But he also knew that there's got to be some standards of practice, which, as he used to say sometimes, give numerical strength. So up until about 1969, 1970, things were kind of a bit erratic. But as more people came, other people became more qualified, then he began to open up, you know, more and more temples. In Vrindavan, I'm just trying to think, there was this, Vrindavan was opened in 1975. Prabhupada came back to Vrindavan in 1970, the same year on his first trip back to Krishna Balaram Mandir. That temple was the first one where he had, you know, three large sets of deities being worshipped. His idea was that there's the Bhagavat Vidhi and there's a Pancharati Vidhi. And Bhagavat Vidhi, of course, is our main business. But Pancharatriki Vidhi, that one, is very important for maintaining you know, good Krishna consciousness, giving or establishing a society on the spiritual platform, Suda Sattva. So the way to do that is to have deities. And Prabhupada said, you see, from about 70 onwards, or 69 onwards, there were a lot of installations of deities in ISKCON temples. Because here in India, he didn't really have any facility at first when he came back in 1970. But as soon as he started his preaching activities in India, that was like 70, 71, then his God, it's just annoying. anyway, deity worship, Prabhupada regarded as being very important. He wanted a good standard to be kept. The Vrindavan temple, Prabhupada had come back after the opening in around Janmashtami time of 1975. Prabhupada came back to Vrindavan to check and see how things were going on. It was a struggle to get, you know, good qualified people to take responsibility for you know, the deity worship and running of the temples. But you know, Prabhupada had to personally get involved a lot of the time in making sure that the standards were kept high. I'll give an example that in 1975 or 76, actually September 76, Prabhupada, he had just returned after Radhastami, and he'd come to Vrindavan, I think about the 2nd or 3rd of September. And he was quite disappointed in some respects, things that we didn't catch ourselves. But when Prabhupada came and he started going over, you know, all the standards, proper standards, then he saw so many things were not being done correctly. And several times I saw when he came to greet the deities, he got very annoyed. They had opened the curtains for Krishna and Balaram. And when the curtains opened, the deities had no garland around their necks. So Prabhupada was so annoyed that he turned to his temple president, Akayananda Maharaj at that time, and he told him, he said, "This is another farce." So he gave a class that what we're doing in building these big temples, we want to attract as many people as possible. But if you don't do it properly, then after I'm gone, he said, after I'm gone, then you'll think, oh, this old man, he's just left us with a big burden. Galagraha used that word. That everything, you know, unless there's enthusiasm, bhava, then he said things will deteriorate. So he was, you know, very attentive to the point where when he arrived in Vrindavan, there was a gentleman called Bhagatji who lived around the literally around the corner from the temple, and he was Prabhupada's chief advisor, at least in Vrindavan. And so he and Prabhupada called him in one morning, and with the Koyananda, the temple president, and he started going over the budget, and he saw that they were spending nearly something like 8 or 10,000 rupees a month, which in those days was a lot, to maintain the temple. So Prabhupada, and they were struggling. There were not very many life membership collectors, and so it was a lot of money. And when Prabhupada saw that, he immediately reduced the temple budget. He said, you're spending 8 to 10,000 a month, but he said it's way too much. He said, I'm making up a new budget, and this will be for 500 rupees a month, which shocked the temple leaders. And they said, well, it's not possible, Prabhupada, to do it for that. So Prabhupada told them, all right, up to 1,000, but nothing, not more than that. And he actually sat with Bhagatji, and they worked out a new budget, and that included the amount of bhoga that was being offered, the number of plates that were being offered, the four deities on Gaur Nithai, Prabhupada and Bhaktisiddhanta, then there's Krishna and Balaram, and then there's Radha Shyamasunda, Lalita and Vishakha. So instead of all the deities getting their own plate, Prabhupada told the devotees to save money, then they could reduce the number of plates of bhoga that were being offered to the deities, and just put one plate on each altar. So he also calculated how much should be spent on, you know, providing the bhoga for the deities. He had the Bhagatji work out the cost of making one puri. And at that time, the deities were receiving, I think, two or four puris were being offered to them. And anyway, the point here is that Prabhupada didn't hesitate when, you know, it came to keeping the budgets for the running of the temples you know, to a proper standard. But if there was a need, then, you know, he could, or he did, reduce the amounts of bhoga that were given to the deities. That's just one example. Let me have the next question. I'm sorry about this. My brain's just really not working well at the moment. How was the culture of offering Guru Dakshin after initiation? Was there during Prabhupada's times? When the current culture of begging Guru Dakshina in the temple premises started. Well, I joined in Sydney in 1972, and Prabhupada, well, let's see, I joined in February. Prabhupada came to Sydney 6 weeks later. And he initiated everybody that was in the temple. And it was the standard that anybody that got initiated, they had to go and collect some kind of offering, collect some money or some other useful items. We were sent out, right, you're going to be initiated, and you have to go and beg some Guru Dakshina. So that was at the beginning of 72. I remember I went out one evening on my own, and I had a couple of friends in Sydney. So I went to visit them, and I told them I'm getting initiated tomorrow. We have to beg some Dakshina to give to Prabhupada. So they immediately, you know, gave me $5 or $10 each, and all the devotees actually, they were required to go out and beg from door to door, just like, you know, the traditional guru and disciple exchanges. There has to be some Guru Dakshina in exchange for getting initiated. So I don't know exactly when it started in ISKCON as a tradition, but it has been going on for a long time. So what was the other part of that question? Yeah, I think that's answered. When did the current culture? It's not a current culture, it's a traditional culture of the disciple offering some suitable Guru Dakshina. So I don't personally haven't looked into the history of all of that, but I think that if you did a bit of research in the Veda base, then you'd probably find some good references there. Next one. Did Prabhupada ever remove devotees from ISKCON? How would he treat devotees who changed from sannyas or brahmachari to grihastha or leave Krishna consciousness altogether and take the materialistic life? Well, it would depend, of course, on the particular circumstances. On the one hand, Prabhupada knew that many of the men that he was giving sannyas to were not qualified, but at the same time, at least, you know, for some short while, they would become enthusiastic. Prabhupada was, you know, trying to get as much preaching done as possible, and it was a struggle. I think in, 1974, I think four GBCs fell down. In 1976, eight new sannyasis were made. And at the same time, the same year, about eight existing sannyasis, you know, gave up their vows as sannyasis. It would depend on the individuals involved. Prabhupada's general mood was that you can read about this in the eighth canto of the battle between Gajendra, the elephant, and the crocodile. There's a long purport that Prabhupada writes there. It was about how a person should be situated in the right ashram. And he said, "I know that we're giving young boys who are not qualified for the job, we're giving them sannyas just to help the preaching grow and develop." But he said, just as Gajendra, he was gradually being dragged into the water by the crocodile. So the crocodile is a creature of the water. Gajendra was a creature of, land. And so Gajendra was getting weaker because he wasn't situated in the right way and being dragged into the water. So Prabhupada, he says there that everybody should be situated in the proper ashram. So if we find that somebody has tried to situate themselves in sannyas ashram, and then they have difficulty later on, then let them become householders, but they should continue on spreading Krishna consciousness and doing their service. So there were several sannyasis, I think 74, Rupanuga and Bali Madan, they've been sannyasis. Then they fell down in one way or another. But Prabhupada didn't remove them. Rupanuga is a good example. He was quite well respected amongst the devotees, 73, 74. But he was actually, attached to his wife. So when he took sannyas, then he started to struggle. And he went back and he went back to his wife. He was staying outside the temple for a short period. He wrote to Srila Prabhupada that, what is my position now? Prabhupada told him, he said, "You just go on with what you're already doing. There's no need. It doesn't matter whether you're a householder, a grihastha, or a GBC. But work according to your propensities. So you continue on as the GBC. And keep on with the preaching." So, same with Bali Madan. He had gone away for some time. when he came back, Prabhupada immediately engaged him as a GBC. The reason I think is obvious, that each person has a particular skill set. And as long as the devotee is willing to engage in Krishna's service, despite the struggle that they were undergoing, that was what Prabhupada wanted. He wanted to, you know, encourage us to do as much as we could. If we were found weak in one spot, then we should go to the service and go to the go to the ashram in which you feel comfortable and can work with enthusiasm. So there was a lot of problems in the early days. Still sometimes we get some problems, but Prabhupada's mood was that he would try to keep the person involved, fully engaged in service. And generally speaking, he would put them back into the same service that they had, you know, when they had their fall down. Another example is Brahmananda Prabhu. So he was one of the earliest ISKCON sannyasis. I think he took sannyas in July of 1970. M. Gagamuni, Vishnu John, and Subal. So later on, 75, 76, news was coming to Prabhupada that Brahmananda was having difficulties following the principles. He actually was the GBC for Africa. And so it was reported to Prabhupada. And then after a few months, I think at the Kumbh Mela in 1977, Brahmananda came to see Prabhupada. And Prabhupada gave him a choice. He said, you know, you can continue on as a GBC, or you can continue on doing your GBC work but get married. So that way he left it up for Brahmananda. He left it up to him to decide what he was going to do, and whether we could stay in the sannyas ashram or not. So the question of kicking somebody out really didn't arise. Prabhupada, as long as he saw there was some spark there that he could fan to maintain, you know, to maintain the fire of preaching, etc. So Prabhupada, you know, he would just try and encourage us as much as possible to maintain our enthusiasm as much as possible. Rather than kick somebody out, he would keep them, you know, useful, practically engaged. Yeah, another question. Did Prabhupada ever remove devotees from ISKCON? Oh, that was the previous one. Let's go back to that last question 9. Did ever Prabhupada ever remove devotees from ISKCON? There were some occasions where Prabhupada resorted to that. There was a group of devotees in the BBT in Los Angeles in 1975 who, because they were working on doing the editing and, you know, production of Prabhupada's translations. So these people, you know, they'd started to read about Lord Chaitanya and then the more intimate pastimes of Radha and Krishna, etc. The temple authorities found out that these people were having secret meetings just exclusively to discuss the so-called Gopi Bhava. And in fact, they'd been given that nickname, the Gopi Bhava Club. And as soon as Prabhupada arrived in LA in early June of 1976, he was informed about this group. He was really very angry about it. He called the people that were like considered the leaders in the groups, called them into his room and chastised them very heavily. And on a morning walk, he told Tamal Krishna Maharaj and Rameshwar Maharaj and others, he said that this is Prakriti Sahaja, jumping ahead. He said, if this continues, then all the preaching will be stopped. So he said, you tell them to stop what they're doing and continue, you know, with their service, but stop this Gopi Bhava stuff. And if they don't want to do that, he said, then let them go out. So there was one devotee, Nitai Das, who had been Prabhupada's Sanskrit and Bengali editor, and he traveled several times with Prabhupada. So he got entangled with some Babaji's in Radhakund and Govardhan. When Prabhupada came back to I think Bombay after his last world tour, then he was informed about, you know, these groups of people, and this Nitai Das, he had come to see Srila Prabhupada, they were discussing about some development of a library in the Juhu Beach temple, which was still under construction at that time. So after they'd been, Nitai had been in Prabhupada's room, I knew him because we were both previously doing service in the Krishna Balaram Mandir. So I asked him, are you feeling okay? Because he looked very down, he had no effulgence, he looked very what's the word? Anyway, it was very noticeable. So a few, 2 weeks later, Prabhupada was in Vrindavan, and then news came that Nitai Das had left ISKCON, there was, what was his name? There was another devotee called Yoganath who had been staying with Nitai in Radhakund. And then he came back, and when Prabhupada came to our Krishna Balaram Mandir, this fellow came to see him. He said that he confirmed that Nitai had left ISKCON. One of the things that he was doing was criticizing Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur. you know, it's kind of like the difference between the Ghosty and Andy's and the Badger and Andy's. So Bhagatji, who I mentioned before, he told Prabhupada, he said, I know where Nittai is staying. Let me go and find him, and I'll bring him here so that you can preach to him and, you know, straighten him out. And Prabhupada said, no. He said, if he comes of his own accord, yeah, then I can speak to him. But if you call him to come, then whatever I say, he's not going to take any notice of it anyway. So, you know, if he voluntarily comes, then I'll deal with him, otherwise not. So there were, in other words, there were some occasions when Prabhupada would rather see somebody outside the movement, you know, if it meant that the greater good of the movement was being jeopardized. There was sometimes, you know, some heavy action taken against them. But on the whole, most devotees or leaders that had problems of one kind or another, Prabhupada would he would keep them engaged, even, you know, if like Bali Madan, or Rupanuga. So they, you know, they wanted to continue doing some service. So Prabhupada, you know, made the adjustment. He said, all right, you know, you can still be a GBC or a manager, but just keep on doing your service. Don't give your service up. So it was more important, you know, in the circumstances that we were preaching, Prabhupada was preaching, it was more important just to keep them engaged. Prabhupada knew very well that, you know, many of the young men that had been elevating to high positions, we're not going to be able to maintain them in the long run. But he did it anyway because he had, you know, a very short period of time left on the planet, he wanted to get things as organized as possible before he left. So, okay, now you can give me the other. Any other questions? How to imbibe this quality of Srila Prabhupada to tolerate so much bodily inconvenience and less sleep. Normally, our whole schedule disturbs even on little sickness or less sleep. Yeah, well, you can't do things artificially. They have to be done according to one's proper capacity. So Prabhupada felt that 6 to 7 hours was, you know, sufficient rest. If there was some, you know, emergency work or something, that might be put aside. But on the whole, the standards of sadhana that Prabhupada gave us were at least manageable. It was not like an overburdening. Say that, give me that question again. Right, well, with Prabhupada, He was just a completely different, you know, personality to anybody that we knew. He was doing things that nobody could imagine. When I traveled with him, there were several occasions when Prabhupada called me in at, you know, 9 o'clock in the night and told me that he wasn't going to take his evening massage, but he was going to, you know, keep working on the Bhagavatam throughout the night. So he had made this comment one time to George Harrison that he said, I feel that sleeping is just, I think that when I go to sleep, that now I'm going to waste my time. So that was Prabhupada's kind of view of sleeping. His daily schedule, he'd rest for an hour in the morning after breakfast, then he'd rest in the afternoon for 1 hour after lunch, and then in the evening, about 10 o'clock, then he would rest again for another hour. So that was pretty well the general standard, at least whilst I was with him. So, you know, if you go to sleep, you only get an hour. It's not really sleeping anyway. But it can be done, but it needs practice. There are things that Prabhupada did that would be impossible for any of us to imitate. Prabhupada was being empowered by Krishna in certain ways. You know, we can't expect that the same thing would be, you know, would be done again by Prabhupada's disciples. We shouldn't artificially try to do something that we're not qualified for. I'll give one example. There was a devotee called Sharma. He was an African-American devotee. He had gone to Africa in 1975 to help with the preaching there. There was a lot of disturbance in the management and our yatras there some time. So this boy got disturbed and decided that he just wanted to chant Hare Krishna and not be involved in any management. So he came to see Prabhupada in, I think, September of 1976. 75. And he told Prabhupada that I just want to chant Hare Krishna. Doing all this management is just disturbing me, etc. So Prabhupada wasn't very happy, but he could see that the boy was very, you know, disturbed. So he gave him, reluctantly gave him permission to go to Mayapur and just sit down in Mayapur and chant. So he did do. Then Prabhupada came to Mayapur in 76. We stayed for 2 months, most like half of January through till about March the 22nd or something like that. And when Prabhupada arrived, one of the first things he asked was, where's our Sharma? So this boy, we had a small Goshala, where the big one, main one is now. But this boy was staying out at the Goshala so that he didn't have to deal with people. And he started chanting 150 rounds every day, 150 rounds. And he would only eat the remnants of the food, that the prasadam that was left over by the other devotees. So he was staying out at the Goshala. And then later on, devotees started coming in and arriving for the festival. So he came over to see Prabhupada, and he asked for permission to build a hut in the treetops. Because when devotees were coming, they heard all Shamas chanting, you know, 150 rounds a day, let's go see him. And so he found himself becoming more disturbed by his external circumstance, and that again was detracting from his ability to chant. So Prabhupada said, no, you just, you know, continue as you were. There's no need for, you know, concocting some idea of a tree hut or whatever. Then 2 weeks later, he came again, and he asked Prabhupada if he could go to Radhakund and stay in Radhakund and just chant there. So Prabhupada was quite displeased with the whole situation. He told him, you can't imitate personalities like Haridas Thakur, who was, you know, chanting 3 lakhs of names every day. So, you know, Prabhupada told him, it's better for you, you know, you're not fit for Nirjana Bhajan. Haridas Thakur was living in a cave, and one huge snake was living there in the same cave with him. It didn't bother him at all, but the local villagers got very concerned about this big snake, and so the super soul within directed the snake to go somewhere else. So Prabhupada told Sharma, if you like Haridas Thakur, then you can do these things, but otherwise not. You're not qualified to chant. So if you try to do something, you know, bigger than what you're qualified for, this is really the point, then after some time, you won't be able to maintain it. So, and that's what happened to Sharma. Before Prabhupada left Mayapur in 76, then Sharma came to see Prabhupada and told him that, you know, as you wish, I'm going back to Africa to help with the preaching there. So Prabhupada was pleased with that and encouraged him. But then later in the year, when Prabhupada got back from his last world tour, Sharma was not there anymore. He'd gone. So artificially, he was, you know, trying to chant 150 rounds a day, but you know, his mind was disturbed. Prabhupada told him, he said, "You're not fit for doing this level of chanting." So Prabhupada didn't want us to overdo things, yeah, work according to what's natural. As you gradually get purified, then Krishna from within, he'll give the knowledge that will enable us to come fully onto the you know, that platform Haridas Thakur, but it shouldn't be artificial. That's the point. Sorry, next question. We got enough time for another question? Or? Since Prabhupada was traveling all the time, how devotees would decide where to post letters to him? Did Prabhupada miss any letters to reach him in time? Whatever letters that were sent to Prabhupada, of course, his secretary would gather them up. Mostly the devotees around the world would know where Prabhupada was. They'd send their letters to him, you know, with instructions that it should be forwarded to the next temple that Prabhupada's going to visit. So he probably averaged, you know, half a dozen letters every day. He never missed replying to any of his mail. He was always, you know, right on top of it. And every day, either during massage or just after breakfast, Prabhupada would go over his letters with his secretary. The secretary would read the letters out, and Prabhupada would make little comments, and then the secretary would write those down, and then he'd go off and do, you know, get them all typed up. And in the evening, when the replies were all typed, then they were a carbon copy, the original letter that Prabhupada was writing, and a carbon copy of that was put on Prabhupada's desk. He read through the letter, his reply to the letter that he'd received, and then he would sign them. So, you know, Prabhupada was extremely regulated. You know, every single day he would answer whatever letters and mail that had accumulated. Sometimes letters would be sent to Prabhupada, and because of, you know, his moving around, the letters wouldn't catch up with him until, you know, a month, 2 months. But on the whole, you know, the letters were redirected. If Prabhupada wasn't at that particular address, the letters were redirected to, you know, his next destination for travel. I think Prabhupada answered about over 6,000 letters during that period of ISKCON's development, and he was there about 6,000. So a huge amount of effort and time. But Prabhupada was very attentive to make sure that all the correspondence was done properly. After they'd been, let's say somebody had written to him, he would write a reply. Then the carbon copy of that reply would be sent to the Bhaktivedanta Archives, which at that time was in Los Angeles. So there is, nowadays, of course, the Archives is in North Carolina, and they've made copies and printed all of Prabhupada's correspondence in two or three volume sets. So, okay. I have to apologize again. I have this medicine that I have to take in the morning for Parkinson's disease. So it's quite strong sometimes, and it makes me, it kind of slows the workings of my brain down a little bit. So I apologize if I appear to be, you know, spaced out. It's just one of those things that you have to live with. So is this the last day today, or yes?
Prabhuji, we have three more questions. So if you wish, we can take more.
Okay, two more.
Put these questions I got in the chat, so I'll just read for you. How do you remember the year, month, and even date, place, etc. of Srila Prabhupada's activities? I tend to forget everything.
Well, I tend to forget them too. if you write things down, then you have a much better chance of remembering things. With my diaries, of course, my original handwritten notes, they're kind of like, not exactly shorthand, but just, you know, brief entries that I was keeping in this handwritten volume. When I decided to start doing the Transcendental Diary series, the books, the main portion of it, of course, is the handwritten diary that forms the basis for the rest of the printing. Let's see. I had four sources. I had my own handwritten diary. I got copies of all the correspondence, including the ones, the letters that were written to Prabhupada, as well as Prabhupada's reply. We were recording every day, morning walks, conversations in Prabhupada's rooms. So that's a third source of material. And then also whatever photographs I could find from those periods, that's also very informative because it shows you who was there. And, you know. So in that way, with these four different sources, I'm pretty much able to give a clear picture of what Prabhupada was doing, what he was saying, what persons he was meeting with, and also, you know, the development of the movement at that time, what Prabhupada, all the different things that Prabhupada had to do to get the movement up and running. So if you want to remember things, then the best way to do that is to write it down. It tends to stick more, but the longer you leave it, the more distant in your memory it becomes. So if you want to record something, you have to do it, you know, in a timely fashion. Yeah. What's the next one?
I'll ask the last question to you.
Yeah.
What was the special thing which you like from the life of Srila Prabhupada? Probably, would you like to share any unforgettable experience or incidents you had with Srila Prabhupada?
There's five volumes of Transcendental Diary have already been published. So pretty well, you know, my experiences are all there in that. I won't pick out any particular ones. It's too, you know, too long, but... there's so many incidences, I'm not going to elaborate on that because if I did, then we'd be here till, you know, next year. just being with Prabhupada himself was, you know, an amazing experience. You know, Prabhupada's level of Krishna consciousness is way beyond what we could appreciate or imagine. So we had to really, you know, be in a very surrendered mood at all times, just to be able to stay with Prabhupada. And travel with it. So, there's lots of incidences, I think that the main thing that I got from it was you know, when I joined the movement at the beginning of 72 in Sydney, we had maybe 10 devotees in the temple, something like that. 10 or 12 devotees. Coming out, this may not be your experience, of course, because your culture is already, you know, kind of working here in India, but in the West, you know, when we joined the temple, that was it. You know, we were really separating ourselves from the culture of, you know, the Western Malachi situations. Give me that question again.
What was this special thing which you liked from the life of Srila Prabhupada?
Right. So, just because going from karmi life into, you know, fully devotional life, it really totally changed your whole outlook and state of your consciousness. We experienced that, like when we joined the temple, it would open up a whole new, you know, way of doing and seeing things. And we all knew that, you know, we all felt that. But when I joined Prabhupada's personal party, I had another kind of similar experience that... you know, coming out of karmi life, that brought me up to a certain stage of, you know, spiritual consciousness, which was, you know, more than what we'd ever experienced before. But then being with Prabhupada was like taking another step up, just from, you know, being in his close vicinity. So it you know, kind of gave me another experience of Krishna consciousness that I hadn't yet assimilated up until that point. And then when I began traveling with Prabhupada, it was like another realm again of, you know, real spiritual consciousness. And if you were careful, you could take advantage of that and maintain your consciousness and be, it, you know, as alert as possible to Prabhupada's wants and desires. So I think that I did, you know, I experienced another level or stage of Krishna consciousness that I hadn't done previous to joining Prabhupada. So there was definitely, you know, just by being there and being with him continuously, practically 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, it definitely had a major impact on my own, you know, level of conscious Krishna consciousness. So,
Hare Krishna Prabhu.
Yeah,
I am Radhisham Das speaking.
Hare Bhagavan Prabhu.
Yeah, can I ask one small question about Prabhupada, the schedule, Prabhu, wherever he went? And very early morning, you said you would get up at like 1 o'clock or something. And then his morning is chanting and translating Srimad Bhagavatam. And after that, he would go for a morning walk and all and come back for Shringa Darshan, give Bhagavatam class. After the Bhagavatam class and some breakfast, you said he would do the letters. After that, how was his schedule, Prabhu, after that?
Well, it's kind of hard to put a beginning and an end to Prabhupada's schedule because, you know, for us, you know, we work in the day, we do our service, we get to the end of the day, the temple closes down, we go to sleep for 6 or 7 hours, and then wake up the next day for a new day's activities. But Prabhupada obviously didn't do that. He was working 24 hours a day. So when we went, you know, to take rest, that was the finish of our work for the day. That was the period when Prabhupada would get more active by, you know, going into a sitting room, close everything up, and Prabhupada would start his translation work. So that would go on, let's say, early in the morning. I'll give a brief overview that Prabhupada would, around Mangalarati time, Prabhupada, of course, was already up. He would brush his teeth, and there was some medicine that he used to take sometimes. And then he would go out on his morning walk. So that walk was an hour. Then he'd come back to the temple just in time to greet the deities. After greeting the deities, of course, he received Guru Puja. And then he would give a class on the Bhagavatam. And then from there, he would go back into his quarters and he would have breakfast, which was mainly fruits, sometimes a bowl of muri, that kind of thing, something light. And then he would take rest for an hour after breakfast. And then, say, around about 10:30, 11 o'clock, it depended if there were any visitors. If there were some visitors, then Prabhupada would receive them at that time, about 10 or 10:30 in the morning. If there was no visitors around, then he would call the secretary and ask, you know, what letters have come, and then he would go over the replies to the letters. And then 11:30 in the morning to 1 o'clock, then that's when I'd give Prabhupada his oil massage, sandalwood oil for the head, mustard oil for his body. And, you know, I try to time it, you know, the right time every day so that Prabhupada's schedule was not interrupted. So by 1 o'clock, we finished the massage. Prabhupada would take his bath. Then he would, you know, chant his Gayatri, of course, put fresh clothes on. And then he would have his lunch. So lunch, at least when Hari Kesh was the... he was Prabhupada's cook for some time. He used to try to time it so that all the subjis and whatever were ready for Prabhupada just right after Prabhupada had, you know, got dressed and sat down. Then Hari Kesh would come in with the lunch. Now, when he left the party, and then it was my responsibility to make sure that Prabhupada got his lunch on time. Then what I did, I went to Prabhupada and I suggested that instead of, you know, having lunch at odd times, can we serve you every day at 1:30? Because that way then you'll know when the prasadam's coming, you won't have to wait around, and, you know, we can bring it in and make sure that we've got everything ready for you by 1:30. So from my experience, lunch period, that would go from 1 or 1:30, and then Prabhupada would take rest at about 2, just for an hour. And then about, you know, 3 o'clock, then he would start giving darshans, or he would meet with temple managers, etc., etc. Then in the evening, Prabhupada would send, after he'd given his darshan in the evenings. He would send the devotees out to join in with the evening kirtan, Sharanarati. And Prabhupada would often sit in his room in the evening and just chant his japa. And then by about 9:30, then, because we were all ready for bed, Prabhupada would take his second massage. That was usually around about 10 o'clock. Well, actually, the last thing that he did in the nighttime was that he would have a glass of hot milk every day without fail. So he'd have that hot milk around about 9:30, and then everybody would go to take rest. Prabhupada would go and lie down for usually about an hour, and then the servant, you know, we had to massage Prabhupada, not with oil this time, but a dry massage, and that was just to make sure that, you know, his joints, his knee joints and blood circulation were working properly. So we would massage him, mainly thighs, calves, feet, and that would help to, you know, keep his, what he's, it would go on for about an hour. Sometimes less, sometimes more. In Delhi, a few times after Prabhupada took rest, I gave him his massage. Actually, not just Delhi, but, you know, many places, like here in Mayapur. And as soon as I'd finished massaging Prabhupada, then he immediately got up and went into his living room and began his translation work. So it varied a little bit. But you could say that by about 11, he would start his translation work. And that would run through till about 4 o'clock or 4:30. And then as the devotees, of course, were getting up and going to Mangalarati, and then Prabhupada would, you know, brush his teeth and freshen up. And then, you know, it was ready to go out on the dawn morning walk. So that's kind of like the general, not theme, but routine, Prabhupada's general routine. And what did amaze me sometimes was that Prabhupada, like when we, you know, we traveled from Bombay to Australia in April of 76, we had to go via Singapore. And from Singapore, then we went into Sydney, and from Sydney down into Melbourne. What did I just say?
Sydney and Melbourne.
Yeah, there was something before that.
You were traveling with him, you said.
Yeah, but I was going to make a point there, but I've forgotten what it was.
You were telling about his schedule.
Yes, okay, Prabhupada's schedule. So one of the things that always amazed me was how Prabhupada was able to sometimes make these long distance flights. He'd arrive, you know, at the destination, you know, he would just go straight into the local programs. You know, he never seemed to be affected by jet lag or anything like that. Mm-hmm. As wherever he arrived, that was it. Immediately, bang, he went straight into his regular routine, yeah. Which I always, you know, I found it was quite difficult. Yeah, you know, maintaining my schedule sometimes, but for Prabhupada, he could just, you know, he'd walk in, sit down, and take up where he'd left off.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so any other?
Thank you so much, Prabhu. Last 3 days, We have been hearing from you on various topics about Srila Prabhupada. It was very thrilling to hear one thing from you. You said that Prabhupada was making a commencement of this Bhagavatam translation, and it would take him up to 115 years to complete his whole Srimad Bhagavatam if he were at the same pace in the 1960s, what he did. So, yeah. His dependence on Krishna and leaving it to the Lord, what is going to happen, that was very inspiring to hear. And also the first day you told us about how like a tooth, one tooth one time and another tooth another time coming out, and Prabhupada just would put it in the desk and would go on with his duty as if nothing has happened.
Yeah, you know? I have that tooth.
And also you told about what all difficulties and challenges came to him in the early days when he was trying to establish his con. How he tolerated them and took different measures to keep them under control. And one of the points which you elaborated very well yesterday was about humility, especially while serving a very great soul like Srila Prabhupada. And if one wanted Prabhupada's association and learning from him, then one has to cultivate humility and submissiveness, and that immediately comes to help to be sane. And that was a very, very valuable point. You elaborated very well with various examples. And also about devotees leaving the movement and sannyasis leaving their position. One of the points you highlighted was Prabhupada always wanted to identify Park and Fanit and encourage them in rendering some type of service to Krishna rather than just leave and go away, you know, becoming good for nothing. You know, that was nice. And
yeah, Prabhupada was... Prabhupada's main method of management was that whatever a person had done or not done, he, in any circumstance that arose, Prabhupada would try to always encourage the devotee and maintain his enthusiasm, because you know, that enthusiasm is what actually propels you into more and more surrender. If you lose your enthusiasm, utsaha. Prabhupada often told us that he said, if I did not have this utsaha, this enthusiasm, he said, he told me this one time in Bombay, he said, then, you know, where would we be? I would still be sitting, you know, in the room in Radhadamadar. and you would be, you know, scattered. So he said, this enthusiasm is very important. That's the main thing. So for somebody who's a manager, you know, not everybody, I mean, everybody's individual, not everybody's cooperative in different ways, but the manager has to be expert enough to maintain the person's enthusiasm whilst at the same time engaging them in service, you know, for spreading the movement. So there's individual necessity or needs, and then there's collective necessity and needs. So to do any of these things, it requires enthusiasm.
Yeah, and he also told us about how we temper between, you know, Prabhupada's standards and our standards, and how we should be careful not to imitate. And you told a nice example of that Shyam, you know, who was trying to chant 150 rounds. So Prabhupada...
Shama.
Yeah, Shama. So many of the things that you taught us in the last 3 days were extremely valuable for us. It was very relevant to our lives. And coming from somebody like you, who has served Prabhupada personally and watched him, you know, and serving him one-to-one personally. When I read your Transcendental Diary, I always wanted to hear from you like this. And it was so nice to have you 3 days. We would like to invite you like this in future again, and with some of these specific topics.
I'll be very, very happy to come again.
Very kind of you, Prabhu. Thank you so much. And on behalf of all the Pune community, I express my heartfelt thanks to you.
And thank you.
We look very forward to your association again and again. Thank you. His Grace Harishwari Prabhu ki.
Hare Krishna.
Shri Prabhupada ki.